This is what should be done by one who is skilled in goodness and who knows the path of peace. Let them be able and upright, straightforward and gentle in speech, humble and not conceited, contented and easily satisfied, unburdened with duties, and frugal in their ways, peaceful and calm, and wise and skillful, not proud and demanding in nature. Let them not do the slightest things that the wise would later reprove, wishing in gladness and in safety, may all beings be happy, whatever living beings there may be, whether they are weak or strong, omitting none, the great or the mighty, medium, short or small, the seen and the unseen, those living near and far away, those born and to be born, may all beings be happy. Let none deceive another, or despise any being in any state. Let none through anger or ill will wish harm upon another, even as a mother protects with her life her child, her only child. So with a boundless heart should one cherish all living beings, radiating kindness over the entire world, spreading upwards to the skies and downwards to the depths, outwards and unbounded, free from hatred and ill will, whether standing or walking, seated or lying down, free from drowsiness. One should sustain this recollection. This is said to be the sublime abiding, by not holding to fixed views, the pure-hearted one, having clarity of vision, being freed from all sense desires, is not born again into this world.
Well, thank you for inviting me along tonight. I look forward to the talk tonight, actually. I always hear about the Armidale Group and how fabulous it is, and it's because Doug's just telling me you've been going here for 33 years, so it's a long, long time, actually. And it's quite wonderful to, you know, to have the Dharma being taught here like this. And, I mean, I was just again reflecting on that little the Metta Sutta there as we talk about it in English. It's certainly a wonderful a wonderful set of aspirations to for us to live by. Tonight what I'd like to do is I'll start off fairly soon if I can with a meditation practice, but what I'd like to do is I'll maybe guide a little bit of the meditation practice tonight, because what I'd like to do is to run the meditation practice into my talk, mainly to try and centre a little bit on what stillness is and what stillness means. And by that I'm really meaning what still consciousness is, so that we can investigate a little bit tonight just where consciousness is and where it goes and just what it feels like inside, just how you can actually know whether you're still or not, and whether you've got the so that you can really develop the confidence to really say, yes, my mind is still or not still. Because this is a very, I think, important part of what meditation is. So perhaps we'll just start with some meditation, and I'll run you through this for about a half an hour or so, and then maybe get to it just into a bit of a talk where we can just explain various aspects of just what it is that we're seeing and doing and watching, and just what this meditation means. Because what I'll be doing when we get maybe 15, 20 minutes into it, maybe 20 minutes into the meditation, because I'll ask you all just to do it as you normally do, just with Anapanasati meditation and making your mind peaceful and quiet. But then I'm going to ask you at some point along there just to leave the breath go for a moment and just watch, just to watch your mind. This is really part of the Vipassana side of meditation, because it will actually in Anapanasati anyway, there is those two aspects of it. There's the Samatha side, and that's what I'm suggesting that we'll be doing for maybe 20 minutes or 25 minutes, something like that, just to make the mind very concentrated and still. But then we'll move into this other dimension of Anapanasati meditation, which is the Vipassana side, which really means just developing the insight that comes from just having that still mind and just sort of understanding a little bit, trying to understand a little bit deeper just where that still mind takes us to and just what it looks like, so that we can the point of it all is really to try and see what the Buddha saw, to understand what the Buddha was talking about when he pointed towards this stillness and to the present moment is a very important thing to understand. So all this goes to the first noble truth, really, the first leg of the Eightfold Path, the fourth noble truth, the Eightfold Path. But the first leg of the Eightfold Path is just right understanding, and that's really where the, you know, hopefully the talk will head towards tonight. So most of us are sitting in the chairs. So always.
Do you want the lights?
If you like, it's whatever you normally. That's good. Yeah, that's.
Yeah.
So good to be nicely grounded with your feet too on the floor, and your back nice and straight. Whenever I'm sitting in a chair too, or really whether I'm sitting on a cushion too, it's always nice to know that little curve in the back. In your back, right down the base of your back, that little curve that comes in, just to get that nicely balanced, so that your back's straight and your head's straight, with the top of your head pointing to the ceiling. Just putting your hands together so that you don't fidget. And then just closing your eyes and breathing through your mouth. And just let the tongue rest gently against the palate of your mouth. And you can just start off by just knowing your breath. You can just even breathe fairly heavily in, if you like, so that you've got a good understanding of what you're doing with that. But when you find yourself seated and you can sort of feel comfortably grounded in your seat, anchored to the floor, I'd like you just to put your attention on your feet and maybe even just squidge your toes a bit and see if you can feel them inside your socks or on the floor if you've got those socks on. And then just move your attention up through the bottom of your feet over the arch of your foot and into your heel. Just feeling your heel and then up through the ankles. Then moving up a little higher up into the shins and around the calves. It's always interesting around here. I'd quite often like to just see if I can sort of sense the hardness of your shins, because you've got sort of two things happening there in your body, really, the softness of your calves and the hardness of your shins. Let's see if you can sense that bony hardness. And then the soft, floppy calves. Then moving up through the knees, just feeling your knees bent, the way that your knees articulate your leg. Then coming up into the thighs. Those big muscles around the thighs. and then just sensing your bottom, how you're seated on the on your seat, just feeling the pressure that's there. You can feel the weight of your body just as you're sitting. But just allowing it to be as light as you can make it by just making your, bringing the energy into your body so that it's just sitting nice and comfortably. And at this point you can just start to reflect just on even doing this much, just how relaxation is already starting to come into your body. You can usually feel this. Sometimes there's a little tingling around the outside skin of your body. But then just moving from your bottom up through your stomach and your lower back. And up into the upper back and the chest area. And as you're moving through these areas too, sometimes it's nice just to stop and notice what you can see. Sometimes around the tummy there's usually a bit of gurgling and rumbling and movement. And certainly in your chest too, just the different beating that's going on there and the rhythms. Or rushes. And then just feeling your arms as they hang down by your side. Just letting your attention run down your arms into your elbows and then into your forearms and wrists, into your hands. And again, just maybe focusing on that tingling a little bit around your fingers, because this is a very sensitive area around your fingers. And oftentimes you can sort of sense that sort of tingling, almost like an effervescent fizzing that's there. If you can notice that, you notice you're already starting to notice how your body's relaxing. Then coming back up to the top of your shoulders and around your neck, just noticing your head. And then around the back of the eyes usually is a good place just to look. And if there's any areas of tension anywhere, just allow them to relax. Then round up at the top of the head too is another place. Sometimes there's a bit of activity. Now we're at that point, we can just notice ourselves sitting relaxed, comfortable. And if you can, sort of feel that energy around your body, so much the better. Just noticing how that does bring this relaxation into your body. And then when you're ready, you can just find your breath. I usually do it just around the tip of my nose, just watching there, just standing guard on the tip of my nose, just to notice breath coming in and the breath going out. Breath is beginning and it's ending. And just to know what the breath is doing. You're becoming like a vicarious watcher, just noticing might notice that the air coming in is a little cooler than the air when it goes out. And just notice how the breath also helps to take you deeper into relaxation. Starting to perhaps even move away from the sensations of your body. We're starting to go into the mind. And if you can, I would like you not to take too much notice of the commentary that I'm making. Just the words that have been formed and said. Just to let them wash over you. You don't necessarily need to grab them and try and understand what's being said. Just let it flow over you. And almost just like ignore them. And just beginning, seeing the beginning of the breath. And noticing the ending of a breath. And then noticing how that conditions the next breath that flows in and flows out. Beginnings and endings. And what you can notice here, just as we're watching this body, our own personal bodies, that we're actually observing the second and the third noble truth. We're watching conditions beginning, and then we're watching conditions ending. This is the condition of the breath. Beginning and ending. And you might also start to notice that the hindrances are also starting to get less. The first two hindrances of desire and aversion are being subdued, suppressed by just the attention on the breath. And you can notice that that's already starting to bring about a contentment in your mind. Just as that duality of desire and aversion becomes less. And you're just starting to go more closely focused on the breath. And then the third and fourth hindrance of the restlessness and sloth and torpor you can notice too that that is also becoming less troublesome and it's more balanced. Because as you're watching this energy, watching your breath flowing in and out, it's naturally bringing about a beautiful balance in your energy. And you can notice how that dovetails into the contentment you're feeling as the desires and the aversions start to drop away. So you're just sitting, relaxed, comfortable. Grounded inside your body. And the fifth hindrance of doubt is also becoming less troublesome for you in this situation anyway, because you can clearly see that the desire and the aversion is moving away and that there is contentment starting to build in your mind, and that the energy in your body is starting to be balanced, and you can see this directly for yourself. You can see that beyond any doubt. And the five hindrances are being subdued as we watch the breath moving in and flowing out, beginning and ending. Now that you're starting to feel comfortable with that breath as it flows in and it flows out, and you're feeling relaxed, you can perhaps start just to move your attention now just to the mind itself. And if you'd like, I'd invite you even just to let go of the breath and just to notice what's there for you in your mind. For most of you, hopefully, you'll notice that your mind is not moving, but it's still. As we move into this Vipassana element of the Anapanasati meditation, you can start to just use your own insight and your own wisdom to notice what's happening in your mind. hopefully you are starting to see that the mind is subdued and it's still. And you'll notice that there's a palpable feeling that goes with that. You can actually know that it's still. And then as you're working with this, you can also notice that the words that you're hearing in your mind are beginning and ending in your mind. The words that I'm saying are arising and finishing, beginning and ending in your mind. Once again, the second and the third noble truth. I say no need to listen to the words that I'm speaking about or even to try and grab them to understand what they mean. Just to know that the words are beginning and ending. And also just the knowledge that this relaxation is now there for you. I'm going to leave you for a few minutes now, just in silence, so that you can just develop and deepen that stillness. See if you can notice and recognize what it feels like. Ajahn Sumedho talks about it as the sound of silence. The stillness is really like the matrix of your mind, the background to everything. Just leave you now just to cultivate that for a few minutes. when you are practicing your meditation this way, whenever you feel, or if you ever feel a bit lost or disorientated, you can always just find your breath again. Just come back to the breath. If you can, start to practice to find the stillness and let the stillness anchor you into the moment. So much the better, because the stillness is a little bit more refined than the breath. So in a moment I'll ring the bell to finish the meditation session, and I'll ring it three times as normal, and just over that period of resonance, just give yourself a chance to reflect, just notice what's happened. What you did right, what you might want to try next time. But most important, when you come back to the room, I'd like you to, if you can, bring the stillness back with you. So if you have some idea of what that's feeling like for you inside your body, inside your mind, just bring that back into the room with you. So I trust you all had some sort of an idea of what was being pointed to in the meditation there, just that stillness of mind that's there. That might be. Could we have the lights on now again? Thank you.
Top one.
Yeah, that's good. Just so I can see you all.
Thank you.
because I want to continue on with the theme of this stillness tonight, just to hopefully explain a little bit more about it and just how it's why it is so important to understand, and how it can really help you understand this, the first part of the Eightfold Path, just this right understanding. Because that stillness of mind is really something that's there all of the time. It never ever is not there. And looking at myself now I'm kind of 70 years old now, so sort of probably closer to 71 now than 70 even. So the years go that quick. And just noticing just my body and just how the senses, my senses are certainly not what they used to be like. My eyes now are quite dim, actually. They're not so good at all the time now. My hearing is much less than what it was. Even my bodily feelings and sensations like that are all, they're nowhere near what it was like when I was sort of 20, 25. But over the years that I've been sort of practicing this, I've got noticed really how all of those senses have kind of changed. Just changed as you get older. But there's one thing that I have noticed, though, and it's been a wonderful joy really being involved with meditation and being involved in the Buddha's teachings over this time, is that I notice that my mind, though, is brighter. I don't know if that's maybe the same for you, if you have noticed that as you get older. Just how the mind itself brightens up. I mean, it used to be something that I would never have really be interested in when I was young anyway, because you were really just so involved with the five senses. Is that the way that you interacted with your friends and with the world and with excitements and everything like that, that the senses sort of help you enjoy this world. But it's certainly true as you get older that they do start to fade. But as I say, this wonderful thing, though, this mind is something, though, that you can cultivate, and it doesn't actually fade. In fact, I think for most people, if we take the time to notice anyway, we'll notice that the mind actually does start to become quite bright. And this is a wonderful thing, because just that stillness that we were talking, I was talking about to you there during the meditation, it's a wonderful thing to use as like a datum point in your life. You can certainly use your breath. You know, the breath is very good too. That always grounds you back into the moment. You're very close to the moment when you're there watching your breath going in and out. But there's also this stillness, though, too, which is a little bit deeper. It's more into your mind, because this stillness, it isn't really a part of the five senses. When you sort of practice a bit, you'll understand and realise that the five senses themselves actually do subsume back into the mind itself. So in Ajahn Brahm's teachings, it's really interesting just looking at the way different teachers teach, because I've had two really main teachers over the time that I've been involved in Buddhism. I had Ajahn Sumedho. I don't know if anyone knows Ajahn Sumedho. He used to come and visit here quite a lot into Perth. But he had a specific way of teaching. And then, of course, Ajahn Brahm with his jhanas it's quite a wonderful, way that he teaches. But those two teachers, they teach very, very different styles. And but in the end, it really does get back to the same thing. It gets back to the stillness of the mind. because when I think about Ajahn Brahm's way of teaching to get to the stillness, I see him more like as a digital monk. You know, it's like it's a zero or one, off or on. You know, like this kind of thing. And the way that he teaches the jhanas, it's a bit like that, because it's you're kind of the mind, the body is there in one moment, but then as you sort of use the way that he practices, I don't know, you've probably all been on retreats with Ajahn Brahm, I imagine. Perhaps the lady that's here for the first time, maybe not, but he teaches this way, that you kind of get yourself to a point, and then a point of stillness, really, and then you add a little catalyst, and then all of a sudden the mind will just turn like that, and the body disappears, the body's gone. And there's just the mind just stands forth. For Ajahn Sumedho, the way that he teaches is a little bit different than that. He's not the zero and one man, he's really more an analog man, what I call an analog monk. He kind of dials the stillness down. You know, a bit like the way that we used to do it with an old condenser, when you'd sort of tune into a radio station, you could kind of, you know, it was an analog form, of technology. And so his way, it's a little bit different than Ajahn Brahm's, because Ajahn Brahm, you've kind of got, you know, it's there and then it's not. So you kind of know, it's just noticeable, very noticeable, easily noticeable. Ajahn Sumedho's way takes a little bit more mindfulness. You've got to be a little bit more mindful of what happens, because as you're dialing down, and then you can sort of be in stillness and sort of not quite realise that, oh, this is what stillness is. And I think this is what happens to a lot of us in our meditation too. We really get sort of caught up in watching the breath, or just doing the meditation for whatever, whichever way that we're doing it, without kind of really using our insight and using the vipassana side of this meditation practice to really notice, to develop insight into what's actually happening in your mind. But eventually, with Ajahn Sumedho's way too, you end up with a mind that's very still, and it's just the brightness of the mind that's standing forth. But once that mind is there, and you've got that mind there standing forth for you, you can always use that, because it's there, it becomes available to you at all the time. You know, it's there all of the time for you as you're living your life. You kind of, you certainly, in my experience with this, you get pulled out. I get pulled out all of the time. I get pulled out into frustration. I get pulled out into anger and all of the other human emotions too. And then all of a sudden, where am I? I'm lost. But, you know, once you've, after you've done a bit of practice with it, you can, you know, it doesn't take you too long to find it again, to find the stillness of your mind. And then once the stillness is there, what that's actually pointing to is it's meaning that you're coming back to this present moment. Now, when I talk about the present moment, it might sort of sound even a little trite, you know, because everybody talks about the present moment. Now, mindfulness, you know, mindfulness is the big buzzword in medicine, in all sorts of, in scientific works and even business. But this mindfulness is really such a powerful, powerful thing. But mindfulness. Does allow you to see this present moment, and I probably don't need to sort of say this to you all, because I know that you've all practiced here reasonably well for a long time, but the present moment is really just the letting go of the past and the letting go of the future. You know, when we normally have a normal discourse in the world, usually we're kind of thinking about or relating back to the past, or we're anticipating what's going to happen into the future. But without sort of realising that the past really is gone, it's finished, it's dead, really. You know, when Ajahn Brahm talks about this, he usually talks about bringing the past with you like corpses around your neck. You know, his colloquial language that he uses. And it's the similar thing with anticipating the future, because, you know, we really, you know, we can have some idea and there's some expectation of what the future might be, but really, in reality, we don't even know if the sun's going to come up tomorrow, do we? I mean, it's probably a fair bet that it will, but we don't really know that that's going to happen. Is an anticipation, and because the future's unknown, and the past is really finished. It's we use the past, we relate back to it, and we kind of we bring it into the future, bring it into the present, so that we can learn from it and do all of those things with the past. But it just takes it doesn't take very much reflection really to notice, so that when we think like this, you can start to see that the present moment becomes very important. Because it really is the only place where there's reality. It's the only place where reality exists. Right here and now. Right in this relationship that we're forming now in this room. This is real. When we think about it tomorrow, it'll be just a past thought. So, but that reality can get more and more refined, of course, and that's really what I'm talking about here with the stillness, because this stillness is really one of, you can look at it in many ways. You can sort of certainly see it as stillness, but you can also see it as emptiness. The stillness is empty, but it's also spacious. So, you know, especially from if you've got a scientific bent or a physics bent, as I do, you know, you can start to see it that way. Just that it's really like seeing the space in your mind, the spaciousness that's there. And it's just like the space in this room. You know, there's space here, but our attention usually goes to the form in the room, not so much the space that's here. But when we're kind of observing our mind like this, we're actually starting to observe the space. So we're becoming conscious of the space. We're becoming consciousness of the emptiness. We're becoming conscious of the stillness. So this consciousness is really a very important way to see it, I think. You know, the stillness, when you think about stillness being a conscious experience, you know, you're starting to really get an idea of what this consciousness is. I don't want to get too sort of involved, because you can get really sort of deep and complicated into this too, as the Buddha did. The Buddha actually had many, many lists that he made to sort of explain some of these phenomena. He talked about, for instance, the five aggregates. The five aggregates are, aggregations really just means it's the way things sort of build together to compound and, you know, become into existence in the way that we kind of we see it. So he talks about when the Buddha it was really interesting the way that he did this though too, because there's five aggregates actually. The first one is rupa. The first aggregation that he talked about is rupa, which just means anything physical. It means this body, it means the table, the chair, the universe, the world, everything that we can see with a physical that has anything physical about it. He just lumped that all together in this first aggregate. The first aggregate is the physical rupa. And then from the rupa, he then moves straight away from the physical, and he moves into the mental, because the second aggregate is feeling. So it's the feelings that we have. And this is, as I say, we're starting already to move into a mental condition. And then the third aggregate is perceptions. So being able to perceive, or perceiving, you know, whatever it is we're experiencing. And then the fourth aggregate is movement of mind. So he's talking there about the way the mind moves. And then the fifth aggregate is actually consciousness itself. So just pure consciousness. So even consciousness himself, he's telling us here that it is an aggregation. It's a it's consciousness is not actually real in itself. It's not actually a reality in itself. It's a condition that aggregates, but it's the first aggregate. And that's what we're looking at here when we're looking at still, when we're becoming aware of our still consciousness, when we're becoming conscious of stillness. We're looking at that fifth aggregate that the Buddha talked about, of consciousness. And you can sort of work, I won't sort of go into this because it does get, there's lots of things you can say about the aggregates. They're wonderful things really, perception and feelings and the way, but those last four, it's just interesting just to notice how those four are in the mental realms. And then the first aggregate, the physical, you know, that's just put over to the whole world. So in actual fact, the Buddha didn't really put that much stock in this physical world. And in fact, when you kind of follow Ajahn Brahm's way of jhanas too, you kind of see that the physical disappears fairly quickly. It disappears into the mind very quickly. So it really is the mental realm that builds the world, and actually we start to see that that's the most important thing to work with and understand. And indeed, the very first verse in the Buddhist Dhammapada is that, you know, mind is chief, mind is the forerunner of all things. As you all will know that verse. So the present moment is sort of very, very important, very important to see. Now, I've been emphasising in the meditation there just the second and the third noble truth too, just the way that things begin and the way that they end. And really the purpose of tonight's talk really is the way that I'd like to just ask you to contemplate the beginning and ending of conditions as they relate to this stillness, the still consciousness, just as we see this. And to do that, I'd like to just mention really the scales of things, the scales of different beginnings and endings, and how these aggregate, how things aggregate to build up to be enormous things. You know, we've got, say, the scale of a universe, the scale of the beginning of a universe and the ending of a universe. In fact, the monks in the Buddha's time asked the Buddha, where does all this begin? Where does consciousness begin? Where does it all come from? And the Buddha actually answered the question by saying that he'd been back over 24 kalpas, and he said no beginning can be seen. Now, kalpa, what the Buddha was talking about there, is basically a universal cycle. So, I mean, we're about 14,000 million years now into this universal cycle now, since physicists tell us that the Big Bang came into, or brought this universe into existence. And, you know, perhaps, you know, they're talking maybe another 60, 80, maybe perhaps 100 billion years before it ends. But anyway, the Buddha said that he'd been back over 24 of these, 24 cycles, and no beginning could be seen. 24 universes. So it's very clear the Buddha was able to sort of, you know, I'm sure that he wouldn't have seen that directly, because of course he only was alive over the period that he was alive from, but he intuited this. He could sort of see it in his mind. He could see the way that that this works. And it's a wonderful thing actually, that it's fairly much in line with the way that that physicists and scientists see it this way. So he wasn't too far off the mark, really, when he was sort of talking like this. But I mean, you'll see that everything really has its own scales that we can sort of measure against this consciousness that I'm talking about. So in this case here, he measured a universal cycle. But I mean, from our point of view, we started off this meditation by just looking at a breath, just watching a breath. Begin and end. Begin and end. We could have watched the beginning of the meditation session as it arose and then it finished. And then maybe the beginning of this night. It's beginning and it will go through to its end. The beginning of a day. A day begins and a day ends. A year begins and a day ends. We kind of we move around the universe, around the sun, and in back at the, so we begin a journey around the sun, and then we end up finishing back at the beginning, ready to start another journey around. So this is, again, the year is like a beginning and an ending. But it's the same for our lives. Our lives are like this too. We were born, and we probably, most of us don't even know that we're this, know that, or remember, we probably don't remember our birth. I mean, there are probably some people around that do remember. I just always interested to hear or listen to Yogananda when he used to talk. He was a man that lived in the 1940s or 50s. And he was always said that he was very conscious of his birth. He was conscious of how he died too. He predicted how he was going to die. So he certainly had a very strong awareness of himself anyway, Yogananda. But he could actually remember himself. He could remember the birth process for himself. But at any rate, I can't. I can't remember being born, but I clearly was. I was born, and there was my mother and my father and so on. And, but now, you know, we're moving through to the end of a life. So I'm sort of probably much, much closer now to the end of my life than the beginning of it. So there'll be an ending soon. So I'm hopeful with practice that I can sort of be as aware as I can of what's going to happen at that death when that happens. But I mean, that might be a little bit unsure too. But in the meantime, I can maybe intuit use my wisdom to understand that birth begins and it ends, and it begins and ends in this cycle of consciousness. And maybe just here, because I've just brought along a verse that I wanted to just read to you tonight, just a very quick little verse that I think it's just so lovely. I think this is actually a verse that Ajahn Sumedho used to love too. We used to sort of talk about this all of the time. It's verse 21 of the Dhammapada, the Buddhist Dhammapada. So these are the Buddha's own words. And he says, Heedfulness, or mindfulness if you like, heedfulness is the deathless path. Heedlessness is the path to death. Those who are heedful do not die. Heedless are like the dead. So it's very clear, you know, what he's saying there in that verse, just how important mindfulness is really in this process of understanding this human condition that we're involved in. So that, I think, sort of ties in with a little bit of what I'm sort of talking about here, just in the way that you can notice these things like the beginnings and the endings, and intuiting the, you know, the birth and the death, but all sort of centered around this present moment, this consciousness of present moment. Because the other really important thing about all of this is really just, you know, I'm talking about the scales of things, just in the scales of these beginnings and endings. But it's the same with the consciousness itself. This begins and ends very fast. If those of you that had did anyone have an idea of what I was talking about with the stillness? Just anyone want to, there's a few nods there. People sometimes it's difficult just to put your head in, you don't want to be too noticed. But it is very, very understandable. You can really you can sort of understand what the stillness is. But the way that Ajahn Sumedho talks about it too, he talks about the sound of silence. But it's obviously not an ear thing. It's not something you hear. This is a mind thing. When I kind of think about stillness, I'm always sort of doing this, because it's like a balance. It's like the stillness sort of goes right through your body. It's sort of there in your body, and it's there in your mind all of the time. So with the idea of this stillness and this this mindfulness of the stillness, you can really start to see how very fast this consciousness is. And in fact, the Buddha said, when he was talking about this consciousness, he said, consciousness begins and it ends countless times in the wink of an eye. Now, I think you can get a sense of that when you're actually with it, because it's just this, it's like a continuous sort of, almost like a hum, almost like a sensation, a resonance that's going round and round and round. But it's obviously going that, it just goes that fast. You can't ever, you know, you can't really ever slow it down fast enough just to see, you know, one beginning and ending. But that's what the Buddha said. He said that the consciousness begins and ends countless times in the wink of an eye. So we've got that end of the scale. This is like the quantum end of a scale in physics, if you like. And then at the other end of the scale, you've got the universal cycles that he talked about, the beginning and ending of universes. So all of these things, everything's going on, and we can measure it, we can actually see it, we can use this still consciousness as a datum point as we sort of watch, so that it keeps us present in the moment. And when we are present there and we're still in the moment, we know that we're very close to reality. And we're also very close, if we are very close to reality, we're very close to truth. And for me, when I look at this, I mean, I always see it as a very, very beautiful thing. You know, I kind of, it's almost overwhelming when I sort of, just the magnificence and the awe that you experience, I think, or that you can sort of see there as you still really understand and start to see what this is pointing to. You can see the beauty that's there. And beauty and truth always go together. It does in physics too. You know, the physicists really only know they've got a good equation when they can see the beauty in it. So just that beauty that's there in your mind as you're watching that stillness, and just the relaxation that comes with that stillness too, it's a very beautiful thing. And then you can start to intuit just what the Buddha meant by when he talked about right understanding, right way of sort of seeing the world, the beginning and ending. Because this beginning and ending, I mean, if you just another little example as a good way to maybe illustrate this, is I always like to think about Einstein, because Einstein, he had this theory, the theory of relativity, that I'm sure that you all know about, and the famous equation E equals mc squared. But he only really got to that equation when he realized, when he decided that he would imagine himself riding on a photon of light. And we know that a photon of light travels at the speed of light, and the speed of light can cross the universe in no time. So he imagined himself riding on this photon of light, and he imagined himself being able to cross the universe in no time at all. And that's really the basis of his relativity theory, the way that space-time works, that time and space adjust depending on your relative position in the universe and your relative speed and the direction that you're going in, and so on. So Einstein's relativity, in a way, really does point to the present moment as being what it is that's real. And really all physics does that too. You know, whenever physicists are looking at this, they're always sort of talking about the universe beginning from nothing. And that's certainly what the Buddha talked about too. But you start to get a sense of this, I think, in your own meditation, as you start to see just the way the stillness is there in the present moment. Now, I wanted to bring the talk to some sort of a conclusion, and just in a little while, because I wanted to talk to you about a man called Ananda. A monk called Ananda. He was the Buddha's attendant. Very, very famous monk in Buddhism, actually. He was a beautiful man. He must have been. I love reading about Ananda because he was such a, well, just about a perfect human being, I think. You know, he was the Buddha's attendant. And he looked after the Buddha for more than 20, I think maybe 25 years. But he, when the Buddha was resting or sleeping, he would go out and visit the sick and things like that. But Ananda was a person, he didn't ever quite become enlightened in the Buddha's time. This is all very well described in the suttas. And in fact, when the Buddha was dying, Ananda cried. And of course, the Buddha admonished him, probably gently, I imagine. I suppose he would have sort of tore strips off him, all that, but just said, you know, Ananda, this is, you know, where you're not really fully understanding yet, because he wasn't enlightened. But after the Buddha died, Ananda decided that he would double up his efforts into becoming enlightened, because there was coming up a time for a thousand arahants were coming to meet. They were going to just decide on what was going to happen to Buddhism. And he wanted to be part of this meeting. Ananda wanted to be, he desperately wanted to be part of that meeting. And you're just reading about him, you know the purity of this man's heart. He was a very, very pure soul. And at any rate, he was practicing hard, and, you know, the suttas sort of talk about how hard he was trying. But then he realised that he was probably giving himself a headache in a way, just pushing himself, trying to sort of push through to understand. So he decided that he would just take a rest. And whenever the Buddha talks about the four postures that we talk about of Buddhism, so there's sitting, standing, walking, sitting and lying down, the four postures. So it was that Ananda, when he decided to lie down, it is said in the scriptures that when his feet left the floor, but before his head hit the pillow, he became enlightened. So I would like to just talk to that a little bit. Just what does that mean? When he was, because in this unusual posture between states, he became enlightened. And he not only became enlightened, he became fully arahat. So, you know, he had, you know, one can imagine that he had the wherewithal behind him to, you know, to take the process for him right into full enlightenment, but, you know, to be an arahat. So I'm imagining that a man like Ananda would have definitely known about stillness. You know, he would have had that. And, you know, our contemporary teachers like Ajahn Chah, Ajahn Brahm's teacher, he always talks too about stillness. He used to talk about it in terms of the transcendent. Because what the way that Ajahn Chah used to teach, he used to say that, you know, when you've got this stillness there's the transcendent. So he said he encouraged his monks to always be aware of what's apparent, so this what's apparently happening in this room, but also to be aware of the transcendent, this transcendent experience of stillness, because this is where everything transcends and transforms. But the Buddha, when he was talking about this, he called this what he called a mundane, still a mundane experience. So even though it's very good to know all of this, to know what stillness is and to be with there, and you'll certainly be able to, you know, it'll guide your life beautifully. You know, you'll know whether you're doing things right or wrong, or whether you're hurting yourself or not hurting yourself, or whether your morality is right or wrong. It kind of guides you with all of that. But I think what happened with Ananda, I mean, one, you can only sort of read these suttas, I suppose, and you kind of just, you know, use your own experience too and so on to work it out. But what would have happened for him is that in that split second, as he was lying down, he would have saw what the Buddha called the supramundane. So just the ordinary stillness and everything, when it's resounding and going around and around countless times in the wink of an eye, as the Buddha says, that is still mundane. It's mundane thought or mundane experience. But when Ananda became enlightened, I think what he saw was the supramundane, which the Buddha also talked about. But the supramundane is like a situation where everything becomes unified. So that, if you like, the experience, the sound of silence, the stillness, the still consciousness that he knew about, just finished. Just finished. And Ananda knew, he knew beyond any doubt that now the whole universe was inside him. It was no longer out there. The universe had unified inside him. And with that knowledge, of course, he would have realized, or he knew then, that if he died with the universe inside him like that, without the resonance of the external universe coming back into him, he knew that he would be not reborn, because this resonance had finished. It had become, he'd become one with the universe inside him. So this supramundane experience is really something that's something to behold, or something to really to think about and work towards, because this is really where I think the right understanding of the Buddha goes to. But so, just, you know, when you're thinking about that though too, just the fact that the universe is inside you, and it's, and you are one with the universe. I mean, just, you know, it's kind of mind-blowing, really, a lot of these concepts and the way that you sort of can think about those sorts of things. But what I might do, I want to read for you again. Just having said what I've said, I would like to just read you the same verse, verse 21 from the Dhammapada, just so you can sort of see how this ties together, how it sort of fits, where he says, heedfulness is the deathless path. I said that wrong, sorry. Heedfulness is the deathless path. So mindfulness, heedfulness is the deathless path. Heedlessness is the path to death. Those who are heedful do not die. Heedless are like the dead. So the Buddha really is very much there, in the way that I sort of see this, is very much pointing to the present moment for this, as Ajahn Chah would say, this place of transformation, or the pathway that takes you to truth, takes us to truth. Because all of the other, even the absolute wonder of just being still in your mind, but when it's sort of involved with the outside universe resonating around with it, it means that there'll always be the possibility of a rebirth. And from the Buddha's point of view, as you all know, the first noble truth of dukkha, I mean, the Buddha was always encouraging us to eschew dukkha, to not get caught up with dukkha, which is really just the conditioning, the conditions. And the conditions come about really because of the dual nature of all everything that is in this external universe. Because you can't really have anything at all in this universe unless there's an opposite to it. If I kind of feel the table here, I can sort of, that's smooth table, and I only know that's smooth because I know what rough is. And the thing, you can run through everything, whether it's light and day, or Everything that you can think about has an opposite. You know, it's very Jungian too. Like, this is the way that Jung sort of talked about it with his psychology, the shadow side of things. But even in physics, there's not a thing, not a physical particle that's in this universe that hasn't got an opposite. You know, electrons and positrons, and neutrinos, antineutrinos, and protons, antiprotons. All of these things, matter and antimatter. It's all there in this dual form. But when we sort of go to grab on to one side of that duality of the dual form, with the ignorance that we have, well, then you kind of get stuck in the, you know, in the cycles of births and deaths. And what the Buddha was pointing to here is the way out of all of that, the way out of births and deaths, being mindful, becoming aware of the present moment, understanding the present moment, and developing the right understanding of the way to see things and the way to practice. So perhaps I'll leave my comments there and just ask if there's any questions. I hope there's a question or two. If you would like to ask. Well, I haven't blown you all away, or... Yes?
The way I learned and read about, say, meditation, is that the self, the real self, has always been there. It hasn't started and ended. It's always been there. Goes through the life and the death and the life and the death, whatever. It knows a lot of things. It knows the truth. It knows that. However, you can't get to it, to ask it or to listen to it, because of living. It's noisy, it's demanding, it's like you say, all the truth, the facts. Meditation is the way. Is if you can get the mind that is letting us not get that far. If you could get that mind to become settled, to become quiet, to shut up, you could look inside and learn something. That's how I look at it.
Well, I think it's a very good way to look at it too. You were looking at it very, very correctly there, I think, because that consciousness, that still consciousness, it is act like a stream. It's there all of the time. It's there when you're born, and it's there when you die. And you're just sort of being born into, you know, certainly new families, new situations each time. But it's, as you say, the same stream of consciousness. That consciousness is always there. But probably the most important thing, I think, just from the talk that I'm talking about here tonight, though, is just the fact that consciousness itself, too, is a condition, and it will finish as an andosaur. So, but it's not like what we're talking here is not like a nihilistic thing. It's not like that there's nothing. Just the same I always sort of think of these things when people sort of talk about theism or gods or many gods. You know, you can always kind of have a god on, so you get this, again, it's this dualistic way of thinking. You know, you get a god on one side, and then on the other side you have the atheists that believe in nothing. But actually, I think the Buddhism as a pathway has been named beautifully when they talk about Buddhism as the middle way. And I think this is really what the Buddha first, when he was practicing himself, you know, when he was going through all his ascetic practices, and because he came from the life of Riley, didn't he? He had his palace, and he had, you know, everything that he could possibly want. So he knew what opulence and decadence was like to live in. Or maybe he wasn't decadent. That might be, giving him things that he didn't have. But nonetheless, there's the opposites there, and then he went to the asceticism, but he ended up coming back to the middle way, just right down the middle way. And this is what you're pointing to here too, and I think the other really important thing too about this is that every person, every one of us, has to realise this for ourselves. You know, it's not something... Ajahn Brahm can't make me enlightened. He can certainly help, you know, and he does. He certainly is a beautiful man in that respect. He helps to point the way. But to understand that we've all got to do this for ourselves, it's our own work. Because unless you understand it yourself, it's just, it's, you know, there'll always be a doubt there. There'll always be a doubt about what it is. So you've got to do this work for yourself. You know, it's, good, a good comment.
Is it possible with all the stimulus we've got
around
us nowadays, that
Well, it is, yeah, it certainly is. I don't think it really matters that much about the stimulus. It's just really a matter about how dedicated you are to the practice. To because it is very possible to do what Ajahn Chah talked about and have the transcendent there and the apparent. So all the stimulus is what's apparent, but to know, on the other hand, that the transcendent is there. Just that, to know the still consciousness. And you can, which is with meditation practice, you can certainly do that. Yeah. And if you can, I mean, a lot of people can't, you know, it seems to be anyway, I don't know if this is true or not, but it seems to be that some people do have a lot of trouble in sort of in doing the jhanas that Ajahn Brahm teaches. Not everyone apparently can do them. But I think that if you sort of see it as you know, like he teaches it this way, but then Ajahn Sumedho teaches this other way. And they, you know, Ajahn Sumedho, both ways work, and they'll take you to the stillness, and that's really where you need to be. It's when you're in the stillness, because when you're in the stillness, it's like you are in a place of infinity. I'm sure you would sort of, yeah, clarity. It's clarity and infinity. But you've got because when you're there, everything. And I noticed this in my hypnosis practice. This is how I sort of bring past lives out, really, just by bringing people to stillness. And then in that stillness, you know, you put the question in, and then out comes the past life. You know, that's really what happened with the Buddha. Did this? I mean, he was. It must have been a remarkable mind, because he just one life after the other, just as this one finished, that one began, and you know, he just kept on going and going. He kind of the whole of his lives just unfolded before him on the night of his enlightenment. But the stillness is really the way to access all of that, and it's really what Einstein was talking about too.
Dennis, thank you very much.
Thank you.
Very good, thank you. Yeah. On behalf of the group, please hit this. Thank you very much.
Thank you. Yeah.
I forgot to mention earlier, Dennis has his own website. It's on your sheet. If you want to look at the work that Dennis does, you can go and have a look at his website.